This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
We'll dabble in banking today. We'll do a quick Greece update. We'll talk some trade as well and infrastructure to boot. Yeah, we got it all from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday today, this one is the 16th of June. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. And we are going to begin with the very bedrock of the American financial system, that without which nothing else. I speak here, of course, of consumer credit, the lending of money to regular people out doing their thing in the economy. Goldman Sachs, long a powerhouse of Wall Street investment banking, has decided there is money to be made out on Main Street. Goldman, reports the New York Times, is getting into the online and app-based consumer loan business, lending for that new truck you want or new deck on the house, maybe. It's part of what the startup world calls financial technology. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains, Goldman and the other traditional banks, yeah, they're a little bit behind the power curve.
Just like when Amazon took the store out of bookstores and Netflix busted Blockbuster, there is a swarm of nimble startups trying to use technology to undermine the business models of big banks. SoFi is one of those upstarts offering loans online with the help of algorithms. Mike Cagney is the CEO. He says big banks have been slow on the uptake for a variety of reasons.
They haven't had huge incentive, first off, to come into the market space.
Large banks, he says, have been pretty happy doing business as usual with baby boomers.
It's a false premise that when someone's 45, they want to go into a branch with bad hours and crappy product and service. That's not how it works. You know, 70% of millennials would rather go to the dentist than go to their bank.
Another thing that's held traditional banks back, the fact that they're banks. Rita Gunther McGrath teaches at Columbia Business School.
If you're classified as a bank, there's a whole set of regulatory burdens that fall on your shoulders that make it difficult to move fast.
The rules on deposits constrict how banks can do all the other things they do, from remittances to mortgages. For startups with nifty ideas on lending without having to carry deposits, those rules don't apply. Lastly, banks have been slow to innovate for the same reason that humans have always been slow: inertia.
It's hard to do until it kind of becomes blindingly obvious.
Grant Easterbrook is co-founder of Dream Forward Financial. He says large banks are carrying decades of baggage, but they do have some serious advantages.
Millions of accounts they can already tap into for loans, lots of money to spend the startups don't have.
But he says they need to get moving on it. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
You know what else is ripe for disruption? The negotiations that Greece is having with its creditors over the next chunk of bailout money that Athens needs to pay its bills and avoid defaults. And in the final analysis, and I'm not even kidding here, stay in the Eurozone. You're totally forgiven if you've not been paying attention to all the daily back and forth of these negotiations, the talk and the terms and the yada yada and the blah, 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 which is why Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is going to catch us all up on the endless soap opera that is the Greek debt crisis.
Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives.
When last we left the days of our Greek lives, Greece and its creditors were in a standoff. The creditors want big economic reforms like pension cuts. Greece's prime minister was voted into office on a promise not to do that stuff.
It's complete Groundhog Day.
Mudge Tabaraman with the Eurasia Group says the story has been the same whether you tuned in last week or last January. The difference now is that Greece is nearing the end of soft deadlines it can blow past.
Greece needs a deal on Sunday. If they don't have a deal on Sunday, their bailout expires at the end of the month.
Others point to a later July deadline as more significant. But Nicholas Spiro of Spiro Sovereign Strategy says rather than compromise, both sides are upping the blame game.
Essentially, over the last several days or so, we've seen the creditors snap. Whilst there was very little trust between both sides to begin with, we're pretty much seeing the end of negotiations.
Greece's prime minister said today that the IMF bears a, quote, criminal responsibility for the situation. And he's heading to Russia later this week, perhaps cozying up to President Vladimir Putin just in case. Douglas Elliott is a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
We're at the 12th hour, more or less. It's 11:59 and 50 seconds or something anyway. This is the time to come up with the deal, but they're not showing a sign of doing it.
Elliott thinks things might need to actually start falling apart in Greece for its leaders to be able to compromise. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Forbes magazine has settled a libel suit with the Saudi billionaire Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal. The prince said that the magazine underestimated his wealth in one of those rankings it does. This one, a list of the world's billionaires. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer about the business of those lists.
The first thing you have to do if you're going to make a billionaire's list is forget how you'd calculate your own worth. Think like a billionaire. Once you're in this altered state, a billionaire's bottom line makes sense. For example,
frankly, salary is kind of a rounding error.
Carrie Dolan is an assistant managing editor at Forbes.
The real value for a lot of these people's net worth is the value of the stake in the company that they founded or inherited.
Dolan wrote the article about the Saudi prince. She can't comment about that story or the settlement, but she does say it can be hard to calculate someone's net worth if that company is private. Dolan says Forbes will contact the person and ask for an audited financial statement. They'll also talk to analysts and former employees, see if there's an art collection. Why does Forbes go to all this trouble?
Because people love that kind of a list.
John Carroll teaches mass communication at Boston University.
There's a total fascination with wealth and celebrity and the intersection of the two. All of those things boost circulation.
But there are some people who don't like the list, people who are on it and don't want to be. Steve Goldberg is a partner in TGinvesting.com.
I think most people are probably trying to guard their privacy and their secrecy. I know in my business, you're not allowed to tell people who your clients are, much less how much money they have.
But Forbes' Carrie Dolan says other billionaires love being on the list and badger the magazine to get on it. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, better today than yesterday, so there's that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The House of Representatives is looking for a little more time to deal with the big Asia-Pacific trade package that's making its long, slow way through Congress. The end of July is the new hope for target for reconsidering the part of the deal that the House defeated last Friday, Trade Adjustment Assistance, if you recall. TAA, as it's known, started back in the 60s to help retrain American workers who lose their jobs due to global trade. There is no small amount of parliamentary and lobbying hocus-pocus going on with the votes on TAA, on fast-track authority as well, and on the TPP itself. That would be the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But the effects on actual people out there in the economy are very, very real. Ashley Gross has that story.
How often do you get to start a trade story with a little nirvana? When you drive into Aberdeen, Washington, you see a welcome sign that says, "Come as you are," a tribute to Nirvana singer Kurt Cobain, who grew up here. That grunge sound grew out of tough economic times here in the early 90s. And if you look around Aberdeen today, it seems hard times are still here. Storefronts downtown are boarded up. As global trade has grown, this part of the country has not fared well.
My dad worked at the pulp mill at Rainier, over in Hoquiam, the one that's no longer there.
Brad Pirog is standing out in his yard, describing everyone on his block who worked in the mills. Not many do anymore, including him. On a January day, 2009, he was supposed to work the night shift at the Weyerhaeuser sawmill in Aberdeen. In the afternoon, his buddy called and said, "Want to go fishing tomorrow?"
And I said, "Well, we got to work tomorrow." He says, "Well, no, we don't. We got some time off." And I says, "What, are we laid off or what?" And he said, "Nope, they just pulled the plug. The mill's done."
He'd spent 25 years working there. His wife worked there. All his friends worked there.
We weren't able to compete with subsidized Canadian lumber.
That's not the only reason, but the U.S. Department of Labor agreed that imports were a factor. So Pirog and his coworkers qualified for trade adjustment assistance. It's been around since 1962 and was created as a way to say, yep, there are winners and losers when we trade. So we're going to help those folks who wind up on the losing end. Pirog went to a meeting with union reps and state officials to find out what kind of help he could get.
And I said, since I've already got an associate's degree, can I go get a bachelor's? And they said, you know, it has to be something that you can actually get a job in. And I said, well, I want to get a bachelor's in computer science.
Boom. It was like he said the magic words. They got him into a college within 3 weeks. And now, 6 years later, he's a software developer. The person who helps make all that happen in Washington State is this guy.
I'm Bill Messenger, the Washington State Labor Council.
Before this, Messenger spent more than 30 years working in a pulp mill himself.
Do you remember when you first heard of trade adjustment assistance?
That would be when we were given the closure notice. I had never heard of it before.
Many people haven't heard of it, but trade adjustment assistance offers benefits to about 100,000 people a year. Once he lost his pulp mill job, Messenger came to work for the State Labor Council to help workers apply for this program. He's almost like a bereavement counselor, showing up at factories right after employees find out they're losing their jobs.
Up to 800 people, 900 people, all in one facility, you know, looking at you like, what now?
Messenger says he's helped thousands of workers in Washington State get benefits. Now that program may be in jeopardy.
As a Democrat, I think I would call on my fellow Democratic colleagues to change their minds.
That's Rick Larson, one of Washington State's congressional representatives. He actually supports the trade bill, but he's concerned that the Republicans have the votes to pass it without the worker retraining legislation.
That would be more than unfortunate. That would be devastating to folks who are thrown out of work.
Jeffrey Schott is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. He says the program does have critics. Some say companies should provide this assistance, not the government.
Others feel that the program is justified, but it hasn't been well constructed, and that the current programs are inefficient.
Schott says in the end, though, it may be organized labor, a group that traditionally supports the program, that brings down the president's trade agenda.
The big labor unions, you know, for tactical reasons, basically pull the rug out from under him.
It's unclear what's going to happen next. What is clear is that if the worker retraining bill doesn't pass within the trade package, the original program could die. It needs to be reauthorized by the end of September. I'm Ashley Gross for Marketplace.
Avocados, I think it's fair to say, make everything just a little bit better. Guacamole, a couple of slices on a sandwich, just avocado on toast works pretty well for me. But I'm not the only one. We are eating more avocados than ever in point of fact, which, it turns out, is something of a problem. Dan Stone is a writer for National Geographic, writing most recently about peak avocado, as his article is titled. Dan, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Kai.
Give me a sense of how much the avocado business has grown the past couple of years. It's well nigh astronomical.
There is no crop that has had a trajectory as steep as the avocado. Since 2010, just in 5 years, growth in the U.S. of consumption has gone up about 25% every year, which is one reason why the avocados in your supermarket used to be maybe two for a dollar. Yeah. And now, at least in my market, they're $1.50 and probably going up from there.
Most of the avocados we eat in the States are from California and Florida, right? But the Mexican crop is the globally big one?
Mexico produces 10 times more avocados than the U.S. and Indonesia, which are second and third place combined. Most of Mexico's avocados come from a single state called Michoacán, and that state is being taxed both in its land and its economy to produce as many avocados as possible much more quickly than any of these farmers had planned.
You write that we are approaching our quinoa moment with avocado. Explain that a little bit.
Yeah, so avocados are taking this similar trajectory as quinoa, that they've been grown for thousands of years by people in Central America. Suddenly, they become very, very popular among, you know, the Brooklyn, L.A., D.C. crowds,
right?
And the price and the demand for it takes off. And suddenly, they're so lucrative to grow that the people who used to grow them for subsistence can't afford to eat their own crop anymore.
Wow.
And because the motivation is so great to produce so many, they really tax their land with as much water and as many nutrients they could suck out of the soil to deliver the most amount of fruit.
You give a stunning image of how much water one avocado takes.
Takes about 100 gallons to produce a pound, and there's about 2 avocados per pound. So that's 50 gallons of water, which is about how much it takes to fill up an entire bathtub.
Not sustainable. Can't possibly be.
No. And we've heard a lot about almonds over
the past few weeks
in California, but avocados are not far behind in terms of how much water they take.
These things have become so valuable that they have become currency, I guess, down in the drug wars in Mexico.
Yeah, there are a couple different cartels in central Mexico. The biggest one is called the Caballeros Templarios, or the Temple Knights. And avocados have become a currency for them. They refer to the fruit as oro verde, or green gold, because of how lucrative they are. These are cartels that traditionally have trafficked hard drugs, cocaine, heroin.
And this is all because we want a couple of slices of avocado on a BLT.
I hope you're happy,
right?
Yes.
Yeah. Daniel Stone, he's an editor and staff writer at National Geographic, writing most recently on avocados. Daniel, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up.
I mean, it makes pre-Katrina New Orleans look like an engineering marvel.
Infrastructure, California, and water in that order. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 113 points today, 0.6%, closed at 17,904. The NASDAQ regained 25 points, about 0.5%, 5,055. The S&P 500 added 11 points, 0.5%, finished at 2,096. Coty, the cosmetics company, put on 19% today on a report it's getting 3 Procter & Gamble brands, Max Factor, CoverGirl, and P&G's hair care lines. The price could be $12 billion, which is a whole lot of makeup and hair, y'all. Procter & Gamble gained 1.2%. United Airlines said it's moving out of JFK Airport in New York City, consolidating its premium West Coast flights at Newark's Liberty Airport. United already, by the way, the dominant major carrier at Newark. United's parent, United Continental Holdings, down nearly 2%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. Donate at Marketplace.org by June 30th, and thanks.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform holds a hearing titled Drones, the Next Generation of Commerce. Courier FedEx is scheduled to release quarterly earnings. And tomorrow is National Eat All Your Vegetables Day. Don't leave the table until they're gone. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're in the middle, in case you hadn't heard, of something of a water shortage out here in California. Droughts are nothing new. Water's always been one of our biggest vulnerabilities. What is less apparent, though, is how vulnerable the water infrastructure is, specifically in Southern California. So today, as part of our series on the increasingly fragile infrastructure in this country, The Weak Link, here is Sarah Gardner from our sustainability desk with a different kind of California water story.
Ask people in Los Angeles whether they have extra water on hand just in case of, say, an earthquake.
I don't have any. I don't have any stored water.
I've given it some thought, but not a lot.
Well, I keep packs of Arrowhead water in the plastic bottles.
Yeah, I mean, nobody's think about that, you know. We're just living the life of that day by day. You know?
I mean, I've seen a lot of water. I'm a Hurricane Katrina survivor, so I'm not really too afraid of earthquakes.
Everybody down!
Maybe San Andreas the movie will inspire more earthquake survival kits, but a realistic San Andreas scenario is scary enough. Seismologist Lucy Jones.
So if the earthquake were to happen
today. First, we are cutting off all foreign water.
Southern California imports well over half its water supply. Los Angeles, up to 90%. A trio of monumental aqueducts delivers the water from hundreds of miles away. One problem. Along a fault line, big earthquakes can shift the ground 20 feet or more, and all these aqueducts have to cross the San Andreas Fault to get here.
So I take the 110 to the 5?
Yeah, and then we'll get off on the 14.
It took a while, but with GPS coordinates and fault maps, we found one of those crossings in the high desert amid the sagebrush and rattlesnakes.
Here we are. We're on top of the San Andreas Fault, about an hour north of Los Angeles, just west of the city of Palmdale. As you can hear, it's really windy. And there's a big sign that says, stay out of the aqueduct, you may drown.
Now, that was the California aqueduct. It carries water here from the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta, another vulnerable water system propped up by earthen levees.
I mean, it makes pre-Katrina New Orleans look like an engineering marvel.
Political scientist Steve Erie.
All you need is basically a little earthquake up in Northern California, and you've got a major disruption in one of the key aqueduct systems that comes to Southern California.
And for a long time, says Lucy Jones, that's what officials imagined. Maybe one or two of the aqueducts would break in a magnitude 8 or stronger on the San Andreas.
It wasn't clear, I think, to the planners that it's very likely that all of them will break at once. A big earthquake happens on a long fault, and the most likely distribution actually takes out all of them.
Okay, but broken aqueducts can be repaired, right? And officials say they have 6 months of emergency water in storage. But here's the thing. All that storage doesn't matter if they can't get the water to your tap.
The old pipes under the streets, they're the real weak link.
Civil engineer Keith Porter and his colleague Charles Scawthorne have traveled the world studying earthquake damage to infrastructure. Scawthorne was in Japan in 1995 when a catastrophic quake struck the city of Kobe.
It sort of looked like Berlin after World in April of 1945 or something. Collapsed buildings everywhere, people in the street huddled in camp chairs with coats around them, huddled around a fire in complete darkness.
Scawthorne says that big quake knocked out power and water. It took 3 months to restore water service citywide. Los Angeles and many Southern California cities are like the rest of the U.S., he says. The underground water infrastructure is crumbling. Throw in a monster quake on the San Andreas, and those corroded cast iron pipes are sitting targets.
We anticipate tens of thousands of breaks, and those repairs are going to take a long time. And in the meantime, you're not going to have water in your house.
Think of the water system like the human body, Scawthorne says. The aqueducts are the major arteries, but they're connected to thousands of miles of smaller pipes, like capillaries, that branch out to towns and streets to get water to your house or business. Enough breaks in those capillaries can bleed a city's economy. Keith Porter.
If you can't take a shower for months, you leave. And if you are the owner of that apartment building, you can't rent those apartments out and you go bankrupt. So we're talking about an existential threat to communities because of damage to water supply pipe.
Not to mention the post-quake fires they'll have to let burn because the hydrants are dry. Officials here now believe broken water infrastructure would hurt the Southern California economy the most, $50 billion in lost business by one estimate. That possibility isn't lost on business people here. Not many are willing to talk publicly about it, but some will.
I am Peter Corselli. I am vice president of U.S. Growers Cold Storage.
Corselli's company operates in an industrial city just south of Los Angeles.
We're going to go into the blast freezer. It's probably minus 20 in there, so we won't spend...
U.S. Growers freezes and refrigerates food for everybody from Trader Joe's to Farmer John, just across the tracks. Big boxes of chicken, beef, shrimp, veggies, stacked ceiling high in warehouses. Keeping all that cold takes about 20 million gallons of water a year. Corselli says they could last a week or so without water, but much more...
We would be out of business if we had an extended shutdown. It affects shipping. It affects everything.
Los Angeles Department of Water and Power's in-house earthquake expert Craig Davis says it's impossible to quake-proof all of Southern California's water infrastructure.
Because we can't prevent damage.
but we need to make sure that our city still functions, that we can maintain an economy, that we can rebound back. If you lose the water, you lose the city.
Davis is among those pushing earthquake-resistant pipes and aqueduct retrofits, and LA's mayor has an ambitious plan to make the city more resilient to big quakes, but money is an issue. Charles Scawthorne likes to tell the story of San Francisco Fire Chief Dennis Sullivan, who back in 1905 urged that city to fund a separate ocean water system to douse fires, just in case of a big shaker.
And it was rejected because it was going to be too expensive.
Not long after, the famous 1906 San Francisco earthquake hit, and the city nearly burned to the ground. In Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, the New England Patriots aren't the only cheats in pro sports edition. Landing firmly on the this is a business, not just a game side of the argument, it seems the St. Louis Cardinals are being investigated by the FBI and the Justice Department for hacking into the player personnel database of the Houston Astros. The New York Times has the story, which goes on to say that subpoenas have been served on both the Cardinals and Major League Baseball. Baseball says it is cooperating with the probe. With apologies to Ernest Lawrence Thayer, there is no joy, my friends, in Mudville.
Marketplace is supported by Full Sail University, offering the 12-month Business Intelligence Master's Program. Programs starting monthly at fullsail.edu/marketplace. And by MailChimp. More than 8 million businesses around the world use MailChimp for email newsletters, A/B testing, and marketing automation. More at MailChimp.com. And by RingCentral, the cloud communication system that integrates with CRM, sales and support applications like Salesforce, Zendesk, Box, and now Google for Work. More at RingCentral.com.
Oh, somewhere in this favored land. Oh, no, I'll stop there. Anyway, Casey at the bat. The Dow up 113 points today, 0.6%. The NASDAQ regained 25 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 up 11 points, also 0.5%. Caitlin Esch and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Madhavalan and Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer around here is Nishat Kirwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.